Chapter 150. That it must be conquered, and had come to the resolution to think no more about it. I shouldn't have given my mind to it again, I hope, if to this prison you had not been brought, and in an hour unfortunate for me, this day. In his agitation young John adopted his mother's powerful construction of sentences. When you first came upon me, sir, in the lodge, this day, more as if a abastry had been made a capture of than a private defendant, such mingled streams of feelings broke loose again within me, that everything was for the first few minutes swept away before them, and I was going round and round in a vortex. I got out of it. I struggled, and got out of it. If it was the last word I had to speak, against that vortex with my utmost powers I strove, and out of it I came. I argued that, if I had been rude, apologies was due, and those apologies without a question of demeaning, I did make. And now, when I've been so wishful, to show that one thought is next to being a holy one with me, and goes before all others now, after all, you dodge me when I ever so gently hint at it, and throw me back upon myself. For, do not, sir, said young John, do not be so base, as to deny that dodge you do, and thrown me back upon myself you have. All amazement, Arthur gazed at him like one lost, only saying, what is it? What do you mean, John? But, John, being in that state of mind in which nothing would seem to be more impossible to a certain class of people than the giving of an answer, went ahead blindly. I hadn't, John declared. No, I hadn't, and I never had the audaciousness to think, I am sure, that all was anything but lost. I hadn't, no, why should I say I hadn't, if I ever had, any hope that it was possible to be so blessed, not after the words that passed, not even if barriers insurmountable had not been raised. But is that a reason, why I am to have no memory, why I am to have no thoughts, why I am to have no sacred spots, nor anything? What can you mean? Cried Arthur. It's all very well to trample on it, sir, John went on, scouring a very prairie of wild words, if a person can make up his mind, to be guilty of the action. It's all very well to trample on it, but it's there. It may be that it couldn't be trampled upon, if it wasn't there. But that doesn't make it gentlemanly, that doesn't make it honorable, that doesn't justify throwing a person back upon himself, after he has struggled and strived out of himself like a butterfly. The world may sneer at a turnkey, but he's a man, when he isn't a woman, which among female criminals he's expected to be. Ridiculous as the incoherence of his talk was, there was yet a truthfulness in young John's simple sentimental character, and a sense of being wounded in some very tender respect, expressed in his burning face and in the agitation of his voice and manner, which Arthur must have been cruel to disregard. He turned his thoughts back to the starting point of this unknown injury. And in the meantime young John, having rolled his green packet pretty round, cut it carefully into three pieces, and laid it on a plate, as if it were some particular delicacy. It seems to me just possible, said Arthur, when he had retraced the conversation to the water cresses and back again, that you have made some reference to Miss Dorrit. It is just possible, sir, returned John Chivery. I don't understand it. I hope I may not be so unlucky as to make you think I mean to offend you again, for I never have meant to offend you yet when I say I don't understand it. Said young John, will you have the perfidy to deny that you know, and long have known, that I felt towards Miss Dorrit? Call it not the presumption of love, but adoration and sacrifice? Indeed, John, I will not have any perfidy, if I know it. Why you should suspect me of it, I am at a loss to think. Did you ever hear from Mrs. Chivery, your mother, that I went to see her once? No, sir, returned John, shortly. Never heard of such a thing. Apostrophe, but I did. Can you imagine why? Apostrophe, no, sir, apostrophe, returned John, shortly. I can't imagine why. Apostrophe, I will tell you. I was solicitous to promote Miss Dorrit's happiness, and if I could have supposed that Miss Dorrit returned your affection, apostrophe, poor John Chivery turned crimson to the tips of his ears. Miss Dorrit never did, sir. I wish to be honorable and true, so far as in my humble way I can, and I would scorn to pretend for a moment that she ever did, or that she ever led me to believe she did. No, nor even that it was ever to be expected in any cool reason that she would or could. She was far above me in all respects at all times. As likewise, apostrophe added John, similarly was her genteel family. Apostrophe his chivalrous feeling towards all that belonged to her made him so very respectable, in spite of his small stature, and his rather weak legs, and his very weak hair, and his poetical temperament, that a Goliath might have sat in his place demanding less consideration at Arthur's hands. You speak, John, apostrophe he said, with cordial admiration, like a man. Apostrophe, well, sir, apostrophe returned John, brushing his hand across his eyes, then I wish you'd do the same. Apostrophe, he was quick with this unexpected retort, and it again made Arthur regard him with a wondering expression of face. Leastways, apostrophe said John, stretching his hand across the tea tray, if too strong a remark, withdrawn. But, why not, why not? When I say to you, Mr. Clennam, take care of yourself for someone else's sake, why not be open, though a turnkey? Why did I get you the room which I knew you'd like best? Why did I carry up your things? Not that I found them heavy, I don't mention them on that account. Far from it. Why have I cultivated you in the manner I have done since the morning? On the ground of your own merits? No. They're very great, I've no doubt at all. But not on the ground of them. Another's merits have had their weight, and have had far more weight with me. Then why not speak free? Apostrophe, unaffectedly, John, apostrophe said Clennam, you are so good a fellow, and I have so true a respect for your character, that if I have appeared to be less sensible than I really am of the fact, that the kind services you have rendered me today, are attributable to my having been trusted by Miss Dorrit as her friend, I confess it to be a fault, and I ask your forgiveness. Apostrophe, oh, why not, apostrophe John repeated with returning scorn, why not speak free? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I declare to you, apostrophe returned Arthur, that I do not understand you. Look at me. Consider the trouble I have been in. Is it likely that I would willfully add to my other self-reproaches, that of being ungrateful or treacherous to you? I do not understand you. Apostrophe, John's incredulous face slowly softened into a face of doubt. He rose, backed into the garret window of the room, beckoned Arthur to come there, and stood looking at him thoughtfully. Mr. Clennam, do you mean to say that you don't know? Apostrophe, apostrophe, what, John? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Lord, apostrophe said young John, appealing with a gasp to the spikes on the wall. He says, what? Apostrophe, Clennam looked at the spikes, and looked at John, and looked at the spikes, and looked at John. He says what? And what is more, apostrophe exclaimed young John, surveying him in a doleful maze, he appears to mean it. Do you see this window, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, of course I see this window. Apostrophe, see this room? Apostrophe, apostrophe, why, of course I see this room. Apostrophe, that wall opposite, and that yard down below? They have all been witnesses of it, from day to day, from night to night, from week to week, from month to month. For how often have I seen Miss Dorrit here, when she has not seen me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, witnesses of what? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Clennam. Of Miss Dorrit's love. Apostrophe, for whom? Apostrophe, apostrophe, you, apostrophe, said John, and touched him with the back of his hand upon the breast, and back to his chair, and sat down on it with a pale face, holding the arms, and shaking his head at him. If he had dealt Clennam a heavy blow, instead of laying that light touch upon him, its effect could not have been to shake him more. He stood amazed, his eyes looking at John, his lips parted, and seeming now and then to form the word me, ... without uttering it. His hands dropped at his sides, his whole appearance that of a man who has been awakened from sleep, and stupefied by intelligence beyond his full comprehension. Me, ... he at length said aloud. Ah, ... groaned young John. You, ... he did what he could to muster a smile, and returned, your fancy. You are completely mistaken. ... I mistaken, sir. ... said young John. ... I completely mistaken on that subject. No, Mr. Clennam, don't tell me so. On any other, if you like, for I don't set up to be a penetrating character, and am well aware of my own deficiencies. But, I mistaken on a point that has caused me more smart in my breast than a flight of savages' arrows could have done. I mistaken on a point that almost sent me into my grave, as I sometimes wished it would, if the grave could only have been made compatible with the tobacco business and father and mother's feelings. I mistaken on a point that, even at the present moment, makes me take out my pocket handkerchief like a great girl, as people say. Though I am sure I don't know why a great girl should be a term of reproach, for every rightly constituted male mind loves them great and small. Don't tell me so, don't tell me so. ... Still highly respectable at bottom, though absurd enough upon the surface, young John took out his pocket handkerchief with a genuine absence both of display and concealment, which is only to be seen in a man with a great deal of good in him, when he takes out his pocket handkerchief for the purpose of wiping his eyes. Having dried them, and indulged in the harmless luxury of a sob and a sniff, he put it up again. The touch was still in its influence so like a blow, that Arthur could not get many words together, to close the subject with. He assured John Chivery, when he had returned his handkerchief to his pocket, that he did all honor to his disinterestedness, and to the fidelity of his remembrance of Miss Dorrit. As to the impression on his mind, of which he had just relieved it here, John interposed, and said, no impression. Certainly. ... As to that, they might perhaps speak of it at another time, but would say no more now. Feeling low-spirited and weary, he would go back to his room, with John's leave, and come out no more that night. John assented, and he crept back in the shadow of the wall to his own lodging. The feeling of the blow was still so strong upon him that, when the dirty old woman was gone whom he found sitting on the stairs outside his door, waiting to make his bed, and who gave him to understand while doing it, that she had received her instructions from Mr. Chivery, not the old un, but the young un, ... he sat down in the faded armchair, pressing his head between his hands, as if he had been stunned. Little Dorrit loved him. More bewildering to him than his misery, far. Consider the improbability. He had been accustomed to call her his child, and his dear child, and to invite her confidence, by dwelling upon the difference in their respective ages, and to speak of himself as one who was turning old. Yet she might not have thought him old. Something reminded him that he had not thought himself so, until the roses had floated away upon the river. He had her two letters among other papers in his box, and he took them out and read them. There seemed to be a sound in them like the sound of her sweet voice. It fell upon his ear with many tones of tenderness, that were not insusceptible of the new meaning. Now it was that the quiet desolation of her answer, no, 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 made to him that night in that very room, that night when he had been shown the dawn of her altered fortune, and when other words had passed between them which he had been destined to remember in humiliation and a prisoner, rushed into his mind. Consider the improbability. But it had a preponderating tendency, when considered, to become fainter. There was another, and a curious inquiry of his own heart's, that concurrently became stronger. In the reluctance he had felt to believe that she loved anyone, in his desire to set that question at rest, in a half-formed consciousness he had had that there would be a kind of nobleness in his helping her love for anyone, was there no suppressed something on his own side that he had hushed as it arose? Had he ever whispered to himself that he must not think of such a thing as her loving him, that he must not take advantage of her gratitude, that he must keep his experience in remembrance as a warning and reproof, that he must regard such youthful hopes as having passed away, as his friend's dead daughter had passed away, that he must be steady in saying to himself that the time had gone by him, and he was too saddened and old? He had kissed her when he raised her from the ground on the day when she had been so consistently and expressively forgotten. Quite as he might have kissed her if she had been conscious? No difference? The darkness found him occupied with these thoughts. The darkness also found Mr. and Mrs. Plornish knocking at his door. They brought with them a basket filled with choice selections from that stock and trade which met with such a quick sale and produced such a slow return. Mrs. Plornish was affected to tears. Mr. Plornish amiably growled, in his philosophical, but not lucid manner, that there was ups, you see, and there was downs. It was in vain to ask why ups, why downs. There they was, you know. He had heard it given for a truth, that accordin' as the world went round, which round it did revolve undoubted, even the best of gentlemen must take his turn of standing with his head upside down, and all his air a-flying the wrong way into, what you might call space. Worry well then. What Mr. Plornish said was, worry well then. That gentleman's head would come up arts when his turn come, that gentleman's air would be a pleasure, to look upon being all smooth again, and worry well then. It has been already stated that Mrs. Plornish, not being philosophical, wept. It further happened that Mrs. Plornish, not being philosophical, was intelligible. It may have arisen out of her softened state of mind, out of her sex's wit, out of a woman's quick association of ideas, or out of a woman's no association of ideas, but it further happened somehow that Mrs. Plornish's intelligibility displayed itself upon the very subject of Arthur's meditations. The way father has been talking about you, Mr. Clennam, " said Mrs. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.